You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be running out of door.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
And I tell you to pay attention because we have an absolutely riveting guest tonight. I was so pleased and a little bit surprised that he was willing to drive up here. It is Raj Patel, the author of the new book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. The back cover has some very provocative questions that should be enough to make you want to read it. How can starving people also be obese? Why does everything contain soy? Those are just two of the things that we want to discuss this evening. Raj, welcome to Mouthful.
It's great to be here, Michelle.
I really do appreciate you driving up from San Francisco. The book came out this fall, right?
It came out in April.
Oh, came out in April. Okay. They got it to me this fall. Or I've missed it. And you are currently teaching at UC Berkeley, is that right?
I'm a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies there, which means blissfully that I get to use the library whenever I want and I don't have to teach.
The best of both worlds.
I don't have to teach and they don't have to pay me. Uh-huh. I think that's the arrangement.
Oh, okay. So that's – okay. Visiting scholar, that's right, not visiting
right.
professor.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come to write a book that – really covers the world food system from the macro point of view, but down to the littlest detail as well?
Well, I wish there were a moment where I could say, and then, you know, I bit into a Snickers bar and all of a sudden, you know, sort of Proustian moment of everything just flashed before my eyes. Actually, it was a sort of series of very small steps.
Mm-hmm.
Small steps from a position of my being very, you know, just sort of careless, as it were, about food.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a corner store in London. My parents owned a convenience store, and mm-hmm. I grew up playing in the basement among the junk food, you know, the sort of the candy and the potato chips and what have you. For the longest time, I really didn't care terribly much about food or about who made it or what it tasted like. But I did care about injustice. And I've been, you know, for a very long time involved in issues around hunger and around poverty and the so-called global justice movement, the movement to make the kinds of globalization that we are all experiencing today, to make them more equitable, to mm-hmm. make them fairer. And that movement took me to Seattle in 1999 for the World Trade Organization protests. And when I was there, I saw an amazing group of people. It was a group of peasants and landless workers and farmers and farm workers. And they marched under the name Via Campesina, which means, you know, the peasant way. And they're an organization that has up to 150 million members, depending on how you count them, mm-hmm. around the world, including in the United States. Mm-hmm. The National Family Farm Coalition is part of Via Campesina here. And they were taking very seriously the idea that if we care about justice and if we care about food, then we should meld those two concerns together in an approach to social change that makes us, first, more aware of our food, but then also gives the people who grow that food their due. So that's what Via Campesina was doing in Seattle in 1999. And really, that's when I started getting very interested in these ideas. I worked for Food First for a couple of years as well, the nonprofit there in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And I'm still associated with them. I'm a fellow there. But it was through that really I got into food.
Mm-hmm. And you say in the back of the book, it says that you have worked for a number of these organizations, including the World Bank, but you've also been dear guest on four continents protesting what they do.
I wanted to find out mm-hmm. why people were angry about the World Bank and why they were angry mm-hmm. about the World Trade Organization, and it just sort of fell into my lap that mm-hmm. I was able to either intern in these places or mm-hmm. actually just work for them. And what I found was shocking. I found a culture that was utterly unaccountable for the consequences of mm-hmm. the kinds of policies they promoted. And a kind of self-delusion as mm-hmm. well. I don't know if you've seen the Terry Gilliam film Time Bandits. It was a film in the 80s. It was very funny. Uh-huh. And one of the characters in it is Robin Hood, who's played by John Cleese as this sort of upper-class twit. And his approach to the poor is very much like the World Bank's. He sort of doles out stuff to the poor and sort of mm-hmm. shakes their hand and says, well, how long have you been poor? They were jolly good. And sort of gives them all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's stuff that, at least in the movie, then gets taken back and people get punched in the face. There's a very funny scene, which I encourage everyone to find on YouTube. This idea of, here we are, millions of dollars, go buy yourself something nice, mm-hmm. You go knock yourselves out. There's this sort of feeling of smug self-satisfaction within these organizations. Uh-huh. And, of course, they don't realize that what they're actually doing in these moments of apparent generosity is exporting an economic model that we're now seeing crumbling around us, and which is also going mm-hmm. to be affecting people in the third world as well. Mm-hmm. So that's why I ended up protesting against them. And of course, these organizations are very powerful. Mm-hmm. They don't take well to being criticized. And protesters exercising their rights to free speech have been tear gassed, have been had their amendment, mm-hmm. First Amendment rights threatened. I mean, it's very interesting. I've been tear gassed in a bunch of places. In none of the times when I was tear gassed was I breaking the law. I was in a peaceful assembly, a legal mm-hmm. march, something like that. It's not to say I've never broken the law, but
those situations.
Yeah.
And it seems very interesting. There seems to be more so, I think, today than I've seen in my lifetime, a real bias against lawful, peaceful protests in the news. It's really presented as urban terrorists, breaking windows, targeting small businesses. I mean, that seems to be, how mainstream people are told things are going on. How much of these protests that you saw and the internship that you did were directly involved with the issues of feeding people?
When I was caught up in Seattle, of course, we were in part organizing against the spread of the World Trade Organization's ideas around agriculture. Ideas which Bill Clinton recently repudiated. It was very funny. A couple of weeks ago, he said, "Yeah, we kind of got it wrong with food in NAFTA. We shouldn't be treating food like a commodity. Food is not like TV sets."
Now, when did he say this?
He said it a couple of weeks ago.
Oh,
you can find
that.
The quote at stuffedandstarved.org and a link to the reports there. But he was, it was weird to see mm-hmm. Bill Clinton, the man who pushed through NAFTA,
right,
then extend this sort of long mea culpa about how food shouldn't be treated like a commodity. Mm-hmm. That's certainly what we were protesting about in Seattle in 1999 mm-hmm. when Clinton came in and tried to save the World Trade Organization talks. Mm-hmm.
What happens when food is treated as a commodity? I know that's one of the things that you talk about in your book a lot.
Yep.
But is there a way to just summarize that really quickly for somebody who doesn't really understand what that means?
You break all the connections that food has with the land and with you. But when food becomes something that you merely pay for and and shove down your mouth, mm-hmm. you lose its beauty. You lose you lose the joy in consuming it. But you also set up a chain of relations of power, chains of sort of the passing on of money from one person to another, in which the people at the bottom of that chain are deeply exploited. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, that used to be known as slavery. Today, the wage work that most of our agricultural labor is produced with isn't slavery. But even here in the wine country, you will know that farm workers get paid a pittance. Mm-hmm. That's what happens when food becomes not mm-hmm. something you grow yourself or share with others, but something that becomes part of this long food system that is inherently fairly exploited.
I think one of the really interesting ways that you talk about that early in the book is the hourglass figure.
Hmm.
Would you explain that's that? Right.
Imagine, if you will, unless you're driving in the fog, in which case concentrate on the road. Otherwise, imagine an hourglass. So at the top it's wide, and in the middle it's thin, and then the bottom it's wide again. At the top, imagine the millions of farmers around the world who grow our food. And at the bottom, the billions of people, nearly 7 billion of us, who eat food every day. But in the middle, there's just a handful of corporations that control the transfer of food from the field to our plates. And in every major, every major food is basically controlled. The majority of the market is controlled by 5 or 6 companies. The market for tea, for example, the global market for tea is controlled. 90% of it is controlled by one corporation. That corporation is Unilever.
Unilever.
Yeah,
controls 90%.
The global tea market.
Okay,
but
I did not know that.
The meat market is controlled by 4 or 5 corporations mm-hmm. in the United States. Sort of Smithfield and what have you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a range of corporations mm-hmm. in any different segment, but those corporations are the ones that are that were able to profit from this the recent food crisis we saw. Those are the companies that are reporting record profits now, even though. Most of us are finding that the financial crisis is really cutting the legs away from underneath our financial situation.
Mm-hmm. So when you are, I have a long philosophy here on Mouthful and in my own life and in the writing I do of eating locally, knowing your farmer, that sort of thing. But I often wonder to what degree I'm being duped or it's a myth. Is it true? Can an individual really achieve sort of circumventing that major food distribution system by going to farmers markets, by having subscription, CSA mm-hmm. subscriptions, that sort of thing? Or is the chain so much that you're still part of it?
It's a great question. And it's one that I think we need to understand the philosophical point of who is it that's taking this on. If it's me as a consumer, then my options are, I certainly choose to spend my dollars at the farmer's market, for example, mm-hmm. where I can talk to the farmer and build a relationship with her or him and say, so, is this grown organically? And if not, why not? And do your workers have a contract? Are they unionized? If not, what are you paying them? Why aren't mm-hmm. they unionized? These sorts of questions. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we're more than consumers. We're mm-hmm. we're citizens. We're full human beings. And sometimes there's a temptation to think that the only way things are going to get better is if we just buy the right stuff. If we buy organic and shade grown and mm-hmm. Sort of rabbit friendly, whatever it is. And I think that's a very sad way of approaching things. I have to say it's kind of an American approach to believe that we can change the world simply by shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's. That's what in some ways we're encouraged to do when supermarkets offer organic or, mm-hmm. Even a supermarket like Whole Foods sets up shop and says, come inside and, we will purvey to you whatever it is that you want, that you want. I think that this food system and the politics that have constructed it need to be pulled down by citizen activism. Mm-hmm. Shopping has a role to play, but I think that at the end of the day, we can do other things. We can, for example, join a local food policy council in Oakland, for instance. Mm-hmm. There's a food policy council getting set up where It's a sort of quasi-governmental body that sort of talks to the municipal, to the city council,
mm-hmm.
And tries to get that council to behave in ways that increase food security within Oakland. That's a great idea, mm-hmm. And it's about democracy. It's about taking control of your government. It's about taking your government back. It has nothing to do with shopping. It
right.
has nothing to do with where you shop or what you uh-huh. buy. It has everything to do with how you and your community mobilize in the face of, you know, McDonald's everywhere or, mm-hmm. you know. And if you go to West Oakland, there isn't a supermarket.
Yeah, there's no grocery stores.
And it's – so it's not surprising that the people there are – you know, on tremendously low incomes. They're going out and they're, you know, you buy a church's chicken meal and you eat half today and half tomorrow. But I do want to tell you a story about that.
Okay. Please.
I feel like I'm rambling. But
no, you're not.
Really
we love stories on Mouthful.
About an organization that's doing some great stuff in West Oakland. Now, I mean, there are amazing organizations there, organizations like People's Grocery. And they're doing, you know, great things about, you know, taking land and helping people to grow things and making organic fruit and vegetables available in churches and things. But what do you do for people who are not able to leave their homes? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, with an increasingly aging population in the United States, you need to be worried about, you know, how are seniors eating? Now, there's a group in West Oakland called Bay Area Community Services. And they've got this really exciting idea. Basically, they're a Meals on Wheels service, right? So they go around, mm-hmm. they give food to, you know, to people who are handicapped, who are, you know, elderly, just unable to leave their houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they, for the longest time, they've been serving Cisco, this kind of microwavable slop. And mm-hmm. that's been, you know, it's $1.65 a meal. But they've recently started switching to farm-to-table food, so food that comes from within 250 miles mm-hmm. of West Oakland. And they're doing this with the Community Alliance of Family Farmers. You know,
okay,
it's a great sort of social partnership. Mm-hmm. And they found that the price of meal has gone up 5 cents.
Just five cents.
From $1.65 to $1.70. Of course, the labor costs are much higher because you need to pay people
to actually cook
properly. Yeah. And that's an art that we should pay for, mm-hmm. right? But here's the really interesting thing, that in giving – when these meals are given out, there's a little paper envelope that comes with them. A donation envelope where, I mean, obviously these are the poorest people in West Oakland. The average income is less than $10,000 a year. But you know, the envelope says basically, you know, it would really help us out if you could give us something. If you can't, don't worry, no sweat. You know, we won't hold it against you or anything. But if you can, that'd be great. And they found that in the middle of the credit crisis, with all these foreclosures, with the financial system crumbling around, the poorest people in West Oakland gave $20,000 a month more.
Wow.
Now, that's really
important.
That gives
me chills.
It should remind us that that there's nothing inevitable about, you know, when a community is forced to eat junk food, that they have given up on the possibility of being treated with dignity and mm-hmm. with the possibility of pleasure through food. And what this example shows, I think, is that we need to take very seriously the politics and possibility of pleasure for every human being, not just mm-hmm. the people who can afford it.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I think it's time for a musical break. We'll be right back here on Mouthful.
Support for Mouthful on KRCB comes from our members and from the new Jack and Tony's on 4th Street, Santa Rosa's Old Railroad Square. Offering American cuisine for the discerning palate, reservations at 526-4347. And from Peter Lowell's Cafe in Sebastopol, offering Pinot and Pizza Tuesday evening, and each Wednesday is Locals Night, brunch served Saturday and Sunday, rustic Italian atmosphere at Peter Lowell's Cafe, online at peterlowells.com.
You're listening to Mouthful here on KRCB. My guest this evening, Raj Patel. We're talking about his book, Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. $19.95 is the cost of this. It's a hefty book. And an important book. It's a book that if you really want to understand food on a much deeper level, how it works in the world, check it out. If you know somebody who talks about omnivore's dilemma all the time, for example, give them this for Christmas. It will deepen their understanding. One of the things I'd like to talk about, because you hear about this in all sorts of places, the story with soy.
Mm.
I was reading the section on chocolate a little bit ago, and because I know most people really love chocolate. That's the way a lot of people think that they can indulge and treat themselves. I have good eating habits, but I eat chocolate, whatever. I don't have the chocolate gene, but I certainly know a lot of people who do. But there's a lot of soy in a lot of commercial chocolate. Can we talk about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, people don't realize that there's a lot of soy in commercial chocolate. I mean, it's only recently that the labeling has shifted towards acknowledging that one of the ingredients in commercial chocolate, but also in commercial ice cream, commercial, you know, pretty much everything, is soy. And soy is the source of lecithin, which is in chocolate, it serves as an emulsifier. Mm-hmm. It keeps the water and the fat from separating out in chocolate, so it gives it very longer shelf life.
I think if you cook at home, you know it from egg yolks.
Right, exactly.
Egg yolks serve as the emulsifier if you're making mayonnaise or all sorts of different things, but they actually get it for industrial production. It comes from soy.
That's right, yeah. I mean, and some high-end chocolate manufacturers still use egg-based lecithin, but some have given up using it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And are using technique instead of sort of technology to be able to emulsify the chocolate liquor.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, soy certainly appears in chocolate. But this is the thing that people don't really know, that soy is in 75% of all processed food sold in U.S. supermarkets and almost 100% of things that comes from the fast food industry. And that's because, in large part, the most widely consumed vegetable oil in the United States is soy. Now, people don't realize this because soy isn't advertised as being soy. It's there for its industrial purposes rather than for its flavor, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not surprising. I mean, particularly when you see the way that soy is grown and the way that soy is produced, it's like a sort of science fiction bean. I mean, the way you see these sort of beans being taken and sort of transferred and then mashed and then passed through all kinds of strange sort of hydrocarbons, hexane to be able to get some of the
hexane extracts.
Exactly,
of, yeah.
And it was. I mean, going to one of these plants was like being sort of dropped into some post-apocalyptic industrial future where there were no people and there were no, it was just it was the machines providing us food. It was all a bit odd, and this is I think it's important to see soy that way, to see soy, for example, as responsible for environmental degradation in Brazil. I mean, the world's largest exporter of soy used to be the United States, and now it's Brazil. Brazilian soy farms are expanding, and in fact, they're the primary reason why large parts of the Amazon are being deforested. They're the main drivers.
That's the main one, not beef.
No,
because you always hear about beef.
We heard that there were sort of herds of cows tearing into the Amazon
absolutely.
Somehow.
Absolutely.
that wasn't really accurate. I mean, there's not much pasture to be had in deforesting the Amazon, but there is land that that can be used for soy farming.
Mm-hmm.
The McDonald's angle comes from the fact that soy. Well, humans don't eat raw soy. If you eat raw soy, you will only get flatulent. I discovered. People do eat. I mean, the way most of us eat soy is through meat. And Brazilian soy, for example, is usually exported in the form of chicken. One of the people I talked to in Brazil said, "Chicken is basically soy with feathers."
Really?
And I like that. I have soy with feathers.
Chickens are just chicken feed. Then, for large production of chicken is
right.
They're fed primarily soy,
and then they're exported to Europe and they're turned into McNuggets there. It's important to understand soy as I say, the engine for deforestation, but also the engine for social exploitation. In Brazil today, according to the International Labour Organization, there are roughly 40,000 slaves in Brazil today. Now, most of them are working in the biofuels industry and sugarcane plantations, but some of them are working in soy. And that's underwriting the cheapness of soy from Brazil. And that's what's making Brazil internationally competitive in soy. And of course, as the world consumes more and more meat, the demand for soy as feed for that meat is going through the roof. So there's we're setting up these sort of engines of exploitation of the environment and of labor in order to be able to then feed this stuff to animals that then ultimately only the rich get to eat.
Mm-hmm. What about the Bible?
Excuse me.
I've been reading recently that a number of products that people think are so healthy for them, tofu, soy milk, that sort of thing, are actually byproducts of the soy oil industry. Can we explore that arena a bit?
Well, it's certainly the case that the origins of soy in East Asia are long and laden with wonderful history about how people learned to transform this bean into something else. Because soy, when Europeans first saw soy, they didn't. They saw it in its processed form. It was always soyu, like it was like the sauce, mm-hmm. Or it was tofu. Europeans didn't really connect the bean with the stuff that it became mm-hmm. because they couldn't understand the processing that happened, mm-hmm. In the interim. And in East Asian cuisine, cooked traditionally and prepared traditionally, this process of processing and of fermentation takes a lot of time, and it's done in ways that seem to be good. The products that come out of it are obviously healthy. Otherwise, East Asia would have died off. Right.
Right.
People in East Asia have been eating it for a while, and they've mm-hmm. been and it's demonstrably not harming anyone. Trouble is, two things are happening. First, the way that we get our soy products now are not through traditional methods. They're, mm-hmm. they're industrial methods that are designed to maximize the amount of stuff that comes out. So, all of a sudden you have all these industrial chemicals being mm-hmm. used. And secondly, we're eating way more soy than normally anyone reasonably would. Mm-hmm. And we do it in the belief that it is heart healthy and all the rest of it. And of course, the American Heart Association or Medical Association has...
they still recommend it.
They still recommend it. But the problem is, if you drink several glasses of soy milk every day, you would expect the same kinds of problems if you drink or eat vast amounts of anything, of mm-hmm. any one single thing every day. There's the problem with the way we consume soy is that we're consuming just so much of it and so little of anything else. Mm-hmm. The problem is not, in other words, just the fact that there's soy on our plates. It's a sign of how out of balance our diets are.
Yeah, interesting. If you were to envision perfection in the way humans eat, what would a form of perfection that could arise out of the situation that we have now? What would it look like?
I don't know, because I like mistakes. The way that food gets better is through mistakes.
Okay.
The best cooking is always, to some sense, it's a lottery. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that said, of course, there are some mistakes that are pretty big that we shouldn't be making.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't be, holding so much of the earth hostage to the demand for industrial meat, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a tough question. We do need to talk about how it is that we are going to be eating meat when actually livestock is one of the major contributors to greenhouse gas emissions,
mm-hmm.
more than transport. I mean, planes, trains, and automobiles don't add up to what cows produce, for example,
mm-hmm.
And livestock. So we need to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the industrial sort of production of our food is something that we do need to take on and reverse if we are going to be actually if we're going to survive the this century.
Mm-hmm.
By 2050, there will be 9 billion people on Earth. How are we going to feed 9 billion people with the kinds of carbon-intensive, water-intensive agriculture that we have today? We can't. And in fact, recently there was a panel of scientists that addressed this very question, and they asked, "Well, how will we eat in 2050?" And the kinds of farming that they suggested were a shift away from this huge monocultures, mm-hmm. but into more artisanal and also, you know, local mm-hmm. agroecological kinds of farming, where you build soil fertility rather than import it, mm-hmm. Where you build an ecosystem where, you know, you eat seasonally, you eat locally by necessity.
Yeah, you sort of build an ecosystem in regionally.
Right, exactly.
So that, and that produces virtually everything that the community in that region needs.
Right.
So that's sort of what we envision as an ideal, and not just as an ideal, as what we'll be forced to do if we
right,
don't.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, either we'll be forced to do it or we choose to do it. We might as well choose. And that way we get to enjoy that trajectory. And we mm-hmm. also get to, I mean, I'm not sort of arguing that we'll need to be ascetic and mm-hmm. that there will be
right.
no trade. I think we should be joyful. I think we should be enjoying food more.
It'll certainly taste better
I think
if we eat that way. And one of the things I think is so interesting, you have this chart about how much time people spend cooking mm-hmm. daily. And it goes from, in 1934, 2.5 hours, up to 1994, 15 minutes. Now, if you take that and you think, well, all this time has been saved, but I would venture a guess that during that same time period, people seem to be increasingly stressed and feel increasingly busy. Mm. And very much my orientation is, you know, it all just kind of depends on dinner. You know, you have to eat. If you cook and you enjoy your meal with whomever you're with, a whole lot of things, including stress, just take care of themselves. Mm. What is so important that we don't cook anymore? We don't seem to be producing more. We don't seem to be doing more of any lasting value.
Well, and the figure that really exemplifies this, in fact, there's some translations of stuff and stuff. I'm often in Europe to talk there. And the figure that always causes jaws to drop in Europe is a figure that Michael Pollan also uses. It's the figure that 20% of American fast food meals are eaten in cars. And when I say that, Europeans are like, they ask,
Europeans don't eat in their cars, do they?
No. They ask, but why? They want to know why. And they wonder, you know, do Americans love their cars? I mean, they enjoy the dashboard and they want to put things in the cup holder.
Candles.
Yeah, exactly. Little votive things, yeah. But no, I mean, we understand living here that the reason people eat meals in their cars is because Americans are working so much harder than their peers in Europe. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, people in Europe have healthcare. And pensions and affordable housing and an education system that they can access without going bankrupt. None of those things happen here. And so Americans, particularly working Americans, are running from one job to another. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a if you're in a working class community in the United States, you'll have systematically less access to fresh fruits and vegetables. You'll have less time in which to enjoy them. You'll have less access to green space. And so it's not surprising that because of, you know, the acceleration of the American working life, mm-hmm. yeah, there's much less time for cooking and for eating and for mm-hmm. enjoying food. Now, of course, you know, culture also has a lot to do with this. You know, television and the increased time that we spend watching it is also a culprit here. But I think that speaks not only to, I mean, it speaks both to the speed of the American working life mm-hmm. and also the way in which American leisure has been taken over by the private sector and by television, mm-hmm. by, you know, things that you have to depend on someone else to provide for you,
including cooking shows and shows like Top Chef. People are cooking less and less, but they're getting the experience of cooking passively by watching it on television. And that's something that I think over the last maybe probably 15 to 20 years has really exacerbated the problem. I think it really that twit on Top Chef can do it, but you can't do it in your own kitchen because you don't have the skills.
Right.
Oh, we'll be back with good news. It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. Thanks for sticking with us. Raj Patel, my guest. One thing, I want to go back just real quickly to soy. And you were telling me something recently, soy, something
yes,
about soy exports and imports.
I was reading in the Financial Times, I guess, a couple of days ago, that soy exports from China, I think, have been suspended, or that they're coming under scrutiny because some importing countries are worried that they may have been adulterated with melamine in order to increase their protein response in the tests.
And that was, of course, the one that played havoc with
milk,
pet food.
Exactly. And pet food,
with,
of course.
And, yes. And with milk. I guess that the milk didn't come into the United States. That was in China, right?
Right.
And then pet food in the United States.
Yeah, no, but I mean, obviously it was the Chinese who caught who were in the forefront of that in China.
Yeah. So there's another reason to know more about soy than you might. 20,000 products, 15,000 to 20,000 new products a year introduced by the food industry. It seems to me almost exclusively to separate you from your money. Mm. It doesn't seem to be something that, oh, we know something new about nutrition, or we have something so delicious we'd like you to add it to your diet. It's just like, how can we get people to spend more money on things that they don't need and convince them that they need it?
Well, that's it. I mean, and that's how the food industry makes its profit. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the sort of deepest ideas that I was sort of struggling with articulating in Stuffed and Starved was the lies that are told to us about the way we eat today. I mean, take a supermarket, for example. We're told that a supermarket is a place where we go, where we get to choose whatever we'd like. And, you know, it's one of these sort of iconic sort of signs that you're in America, certainly for immigrants like me, where you go into a big supermarket and you see just way more stuff than you've ever seen before in one place. And yet, the architecture of supermarkets is designed not to cater to our faculties of choice and of rationality, but to subvert them. So here's a very straightforward example. Why is it that the milk is always at the back in supermarkets?
To make you walk through the store?
Exactly. And every you know, from Walmart to Whole Foods, the milk is always at the back.
Yeah.
And there's a golden triangle between the entrance and the milk and the checkout where corporations bid to have their products facing us at eye level so that we might impulse purchase our way to the milk and then to the checkout. But yeah, there are other things going on in supermarkets, like the music, for example. There's a debate at the moment around what sort of music makes you buy more food, and whether it's sort of a 1-2 cha 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 sort of rumba, or is it sort of depressing sort of oh, I'm going to die kind of music? And it turns out that it's the depressing music that's winning, and so
really?
As a result, millions of innocent people have been exposed to Annie Lennox.
Oh.
I know, it's a tragedy.
There's another benefit from shopping at the farmer's market.
And even things like bakeries. I mean, why do supermarkets now have bakeries in them? I'm sure we all remember that there was a time where that would
you
have been
mad. You
had
to go to a different bakery. Right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But now
smell
supermarkets,
of, the smell.
Exactly, the smell of baking bread makes you buy more stuff. I think that this is all in service of making the point that we are being lied to. It's not that food is made for us, mm-hmm. but increasingly we are being made for our food. And that's a really odd thing to say, but think about mm-hmm. it for a second. I mean, if you compare what we consider normal to what our great-grandparents would have considered normal, there's a vast gulf. I mean, think of something like Red Bull. Now, I have to admit that my doctoral dissertation was fueled by Red Bull. I was very unhealthy and quite spotty by the end of it. But what's in Red Bull? Red Bull is sugar, it's water, it's carbonation, it's caffeine, and then it's a range of amino acids that are most frequently found in urine. Now, if you said to your great-grandparents, look, this stuff is great, it'll keep you awake, and so what's in it? Well, it's sugar, it's caffeine, and it's wee. They would obviously think you mad. And yet we are – all of a sudden it's normal, and in fact it's being sold as something that adds to your life. It gives you an extra hour in the day.
And it's supposed to be – it's being sold as sort of hip.
It's hip, and it, but I mean, in a sense – It's something that has a much longer pedigree. It's a drink that keeps you awake so that you can work hard. And that, you know, tea, for example, in the Industrial Revolution in Britain, served a similar function. The sugar in sugary tea mm-hmm. was responsible for, you know, nigh on 50% of British working class calories by, you know, in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these caffeinated sugary drinks are inventions that have accompanied the pace of our working life today. But I guess the point being here that they don't serve to make our lives any better. They don't serve, you know, a function in terms of being gorgeous and lovely and you know, mm-hmm. sensual, great products. That they fit into our lives in ways that are you know, almost utilitarian. And in that sense, mm-hmm. we need to be educated into why it is that Red Bull is an appropriate thing. But now we've come so very far from understanding food as, you know, something that comes out of the ground, something that you can prepare yourself, that actually, we've been transformed into creatures very badly prepared to eat properly mm-hmm. And to enjoy our food and to connect with those who grow it.
And what does one do to make that shift to wanting things that are better? I mean, I think you make a really great point when you say that illusion of consumer demand, but, you know, that whole idea, but I like Big Macs, but mm-hmm. I like the taste of that. And I think we're in trouble, actually, with a young generation whose parents have catered to this idea of kids' timid palates, and they've really given them very bland, high salt, high sugar foods, and that combined with the fact that they're not seeing their parents cook. I wonder, because they're not going to have that food is nostalgia. I mean, I can taste certain things. I mean, I can take a bite of good watermelon, and suddenly I could talk to you for hours about what I see from when I was 3 and 4 years old. And I worry that, you know, we've got these kids who are going to be, a Big Mac will be their nostalgia trigger. Mm-hmm. And I find that scary.
It is. I mean, you know, in the talks that I give around this book, you know, I'm often able to say, yeah, everyone here remembers their first proper tasting tomato, and everyone will sort of raise their hand, because tomatoes, you know, everyone remembers a time when they actually tasted of something, and everyone can agree now that in fact they are sort of thick, fleshy things that are mostly water. I mean, you know, beautiful. You know, there's a sort of geometric perfection about them. These wonderful red spheres that taste of nothing,
Nothing at all.
But yeah, I mean, everyone has that cultural reference, and I think you're right that in the United States, in particular. That's being lost. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's to the great detriment of the United States. I mean, the U.S. is now the world's most obese country.
Frightening.
And you're seeing that the consequences of the U.S. diet coming home to roost here. You're seeing life expectancy falling in rural areas in the United States, particularly among women. And partly that's to do with smoking, but a lot of it's to do with diet. Now, when you see the consequences of the U.S. diet, I think then you get into a space where what one does becomes important. And so, to answer your question, I think our solution is not to feel guilty about the way we eat today. And I think, unfortunately, that's too often an approach that people have. You know, when they're making sort of decisions in the supermarket, they're like, "Oh God, no, I can't have this. You know, there's a blood of 1,000 children on this. I'm going to have that." And people are sort of weighed down by the burden of this. And I think we shouldn't get guilty. We should get angry. I think anger is a far more potent force for social change, but it's also much more liberating.
Yes, because it's much more motivating.
Absolutely.
Guilt just makes you want to go to bed.
Right, right. And I think anger at the way that we are being forced to consume certain kinds of things is a far more, I mean, appropriate response. I mean, if people are exploiting people in the third world, why should we feel guilty about that? We shouldn't. We should feel angry about that.
Yeah.
And insofar as those same forces are exploiting us and manipulating us, I think, you know, we have every reason to get a little angry. Mm-hmm. And I think that luckily there are things that we can do, like, you know, a food policy council, or, you know, make sure that your kids are eating well, get involved with your school to make sure that they're, you know, that there are great farm to table projects for kids locally, so that kids can have those cultural reference that you were talking about, and they pick them up from school. Alice Waters has great things happening at the Edible Schoolyard.
Absolutely.
That should be happening everywhere.
Yeah, and, you know, cook with your kids, eat with your
Absolutely.
Kids. Let's talk a little bit about your website.
What can I say?
You're keeping things updated, right?
I am. And if you go to stuffedandstarved.org, you'll find various bits and pieces that I've been trawling through. Later tonight, I'll be writing up the new Burger King advert. I don't know if people... this is something that's going to get a lot of play over the next couple of days. Burger King sent a team of crack anthropologists out to parts of the world that didn't have any exposure to, that hadn't been marketed to. And they did these blind taste tests where they presented either McDonald's or Burger King to these exotic-looking people. It's kind of Borat does burgers. And it's so disgusting in the way that it presents civilization, in the way that it presents these people as pathetically backward and, you know, wearing weird knitwear. And it's really depressing. So that's what I'll be writing up at Stuffed and Starved soon. Basically I'm trying to provide the lessons that are available in the book up for, you know, online for free, because I think, you know, you shouldn't have to buy the book to be able to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another book project in the works?
I do. I'm really interested in prices. I'm interested in what the market leaves out. You know, when we buy a banana, for example. Mm-hmm. That banana reflects, you know, pennies. Less than a penny in that banana goes to the people who actually picked it. And none of the cost of that banana is reflected. I mean, none of the environmental damage that it cost to get that banana from Central America to here and is reflected in the price. And, you know, the absolute sort of immiseration of Central American economies, what we call banana republics, well, those were set up by the banana corporations. And the price of destroying Central America is also not present in our bananas. So the market's not doing the right. It's not doing its job. It's not actually reflecting costs, and so I'm interested in getting underneath that. Mm-hmm. And so the book uses a quote from Oscar Wilde called the book's called The Value of Nothing, and the Wilde quote is, "People today know the price of everything and the value of nothing."
Mm. Yes, that's one of my favorite Oscar. I'm a big fan of Oscar Wilde. He was probably my nemesis in graduate school, but that's another story. Well, Raj, thank you so much. This is really a really good book, just really, really good and compelling and smart. Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, Raj Patel, P-A-T-E-L. And again, it's stuffedandstarved.org.
That's right.
So check it out. Will you come back sometime?
I'd love to.
You're really... I love how you talk. I love the depth at which you're approaching this really important subject. I hope you've enjoyed the hour as much as I have here on Mouthful. Be sure to tune in next week when we are going to have at least half a local. He's half local. Clark Wolf, a force of nature, spends a lot of time at his home in Guerneville, but a lot of time also in New York City, where he has an apartment. And now he has his first book. It's about cheese, artisan cheese throughout the United States. It's been a labor of love of Clark since he helped open Oakville Grocery in San Francisco in the 80s. So we'll have Clark Wolf and maybe a couple cheesemakers with us too. Until then, have a great week. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. And enjoy dinner together. I'll see you next Sunday. It's Michelle Jordan.